Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The top diplomat of the United States lays blame in the Mideast conflict. There have been some major developments in the shooting down of a Malaysian jetliner over Ukraine. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is blaming Hamas for the continued fighting in the Gaza Strip, with Israeli attacks killing at least 60 more Palestinians on Sunday. In a string of television interviews Sunday, the top U.S. diplomat said the Hamas militants have stubbornly refused to accept a ceasefire to stop the nearly two-week conflict that has left at least 425 Gaza residents dead, most of them civilians, while Israel has sustained 20 deaths. Palestinians reported a rising death toll Sunday as Israeli forces battered the Shijaya area of Gaza during a ground and air offensive against Hamas. Thousands of Palestinians fled the district, where the streets were strewn with casualties and rubble. Palestinian health officials report more than 60 deaths during Sunday's fighting in Shijaya. VOA's Gabe Joselo reports more than 400 Palestinians have been killed in Operation Protective Edge, Israel's military response to Hamas's rocket attacks.
Military forces began pounding the Shijaya neighborhood overnight, leaving civilians dead in the streets and reducing buildings and infrastructure to rubble. An Israeli military spokesman, Captain Eitan Buchman, said Israeli forces faced heavy resistance from militants in the area.
This is not your standard Gaza suburb. This is a fortified area. There's literally an entire underground network. We've discovered 10 terror tunnels dug underground. We encountered anti-tank missiles, RPGs, and light arms fire fired from windows and fired from residences inside of Shijaya.
Gaza resident Anas Hamra, who lives on the coast of the territory, told VOA he and his family huddled together in one room during the previous night, which he described as the most terrifying period since the operations began.
No one is safe. Nowhere is safe. Because you move, you're a potential target.
Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Rebels in eastern Ukraine took control Sunday of the bodies recovered from the downed Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, and U.S. and European leaders demanded that Russian President Vladimir Putin make sure rebels give international investigators full access to the crash site. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on NBC Television's Meet the Press program said Ukraine separatists were to blame for the downing of the aircraft, adding there was extraordinary circumstantial evidence that showed Russia was almost certainly complicit in arming the rebels.
You know, there's a buildup of extraordinary circumstantial evidence. You know, I'm a former prosecutor. I've tried cases on circumstantial evidence. It's powerful here. But even more importantly, we picked up the imagery of this launch. We know the trajectory. We know where it came from. We know the timing. And it was exactly at the time that this aircraft disappeared from the radar. We also know from voice identification that the separatists were bragging about shooting it down afterwards. So there's a stacking up of evidence here which Russia needs to help account for.
The key question of who controlled the collection of evidence at the sprawling crash site in rebel-held territory dominated the day's rapid-fire developments. International monitors say armed rebels have limited their access to the crash site, and Ukrainian officials said armed rebels took the bodies away from their workers by force. Heavy fighting around Libya's largest airport killed at least four people Sunday amid a grim resurgence of violence in that country as rival militias enter a second week of deadly clashes. The renewed battle between the Zintan militia, which controls Tripoli International Airport, and armed Islamist fighters comes 2 days after attempts at a ceasefire between the two groups collapsed. Witnesses said fighting Sunday spilled into residential neighborhoods around the airport, where a standoff began a week ago, paralyzing flights into and out of the capital. The strongest typhoon to hit southern China in four decades has killed 18 people and destroyed tens of thousands of homes. The government and state media said, while in the Philippines, the death toll from the storm's earlier destruction rose to 94. Typhoon Ramasan killed 9 people, left 5 missing after hitting Hainan Island on Friday off China's southern coast. That according to the Civil Affairs Ministry. I'm Ira Melman reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We're coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
I have been living with HIV for 5 years. I am HIV positive because of lack of information. What happened to me is common throughout our region and the world.
An international AIDS conference is underway in Melbourne, Australia.
We have 3 cases that we have confirmed in Freetown. All the 3 positive cases were people who left the eastern part of Australia and came to Freetown.
A senior medical officer confirms cases of the Ebola virus in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
I have also had the opportunity to interact with a cross-section of government officials from Capitol Hill to the State Department. And I have also been able to meet with non-governmental organizations like Polaris Project and Coalition Against Child Labor.
And young African leaders attended this year's conference in the United States. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. This year's Global AIDS Conference has ambitious goals, notably to eradicate the HIV/AIDS virus by 2030. As VOA's Anita Powell reports from the summit opening in Melbourne, Australia, a cloud hung over the proceedings caused by the death of 6 researchers and AIDS experts who were among those killed on a Malaysia Airlines flight shut down over volatile eastern Ukraine.
During the next week, about 12,000 delegates at this massive international event will discuss nearly every facet of the virus that has confounded the world for more than 3 decades. They will discuss everything from the hard science behind HIV treatment to how the virus affects families and societies around the world. But first, they observed a minute of somber silence for the 6 top researchers and activists who were killed Thursday en route to the conference, when pro-Russian rebels in rest of eastern Ukraine allegedly shot down their commercial plane, killing all 298 people aboard. International AIDS Society President Françoise Barré-Sinoussi expressed grief over the loss of the researchers, which included her predecessor, leading Dutch researcher Dr. Joop Lange.
I would love to be telling you that we were opening this conference in happier times. The extent of the loss of our colleagues and friends is still hard for me to express. We grieve alongside all those throughout the world who have lost family and friends in this senseless tragedy.
But HIV-positive delegates said they would not let the tragedy divert attention from the greater cause. Ayu Uktariani is a board member of the Indonesian Positive Women's Network.
I have been living with HIV for 5 years. I am HIV-positive because of lack of information. What happened to me is common throughout our region and the world. I come from the most populous Muslim country, but our situation is not unique. I am surrounded by peers from other countries, Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, and we all face the same problem. Many of us got HIV because we did not have the means to protect ourselves.
She says she and fellow patients are crucial to the fight against AIDS.
HIV cannot be solved by science alone. Because of the stigma of HIV, we need to include people living with HIV in the response.
Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott also addressed the conference via satellite and expressed both sadness and anger over the deadly plane crash, which killed 36 Australian citizens and residents. The head of the UN AIDS body, Michelle Sidibe, also expressed determination and anger and some serious goals.
Today, I am calling for ending AIDS by 2030. My vision for ending AIDS looks like this: voluntary testing and treatment reaching everyone everywhere, each person with HIV reaching viral suppression. No one dies from AIDS or is born with HIV. People living with HIV live with dignity, protected by laws, and free to move anywhere in the world. This vision is not just my own vision. It is from my friend and mentor, Joop Lange. His vision will stay with me until it becomes a reality.
The conference continues through Friday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Melbourne, Australia.
Meanwhile, Malaysia's state-owned airline is facing questions about its survival after being hit with back-to-back disasters. Steve Herman reports for VOA from Kuala Lumpur.
Even before the loss of two jets loaded with passengers on international flights, Malaysia Airlines had been operating in the red for 3 years, accumulating a deficit of $1.3 billion. U.S. and Ukrainian intelligence officials say Malaysia's Flight 17, flying at an altitude of 10,000 meters Thursday, was brought down by a surface-to-air missile, almost certainly supplied to the rebels by Russia. That occurred as Malaysia's flag carrier was still reeling from the loss of Flight 370. The Kuala Lumpur to Beijing flight disappeared March 8th after veering far off course. Mohsin Aziz, aviation analyst for Maybank, Malaysia's largest financial group, describes the airline's situation as very dire.
We would expect that financial problems would definitely be taking a bigger hit, and I don't think Malaysia Airlines can survive in its current form by the end of the year.
Aziz says Malaysia Airlines will still enjoy the support of the government, whose officials are mandated to fly the carrier, and a sympathetic Malaysian public, which identifies the airline as integral to the nation.
After viewing this company, analyzing this company for a long, long time, I think they only have a business case domestically. Internationally, no chance.
Malaysia Airlines faced criticism and a loss of trust for its slow reaction to the disappearance of Flight 370. Despite an extensive search in waters off the Western Australian coast, there has been no trace of the jet and no conclusion about why it vanished. Since last week's downing of Flight 17, there has been further criticism of the airline for flying over a conflict zone instead of taking a longer path that would have consumed more fuel, as some other airlines had done. The troubled airline has already received three bailouts through Malaysia's sovereign fund and will need a fourth huge injection of cash to survive in any form, according to industry analysts. The carrier is offering until Thursday full refunds to customers who want to cancel their tickets on any flight, and no penalties for changing dates for those preferring to delay travel. And the carrier says effective Friday, it will be retiring flight code MH17 as a mark of respect for the 298 people killed in the crash. The airline also says it has no immediate plans to fly Flight 17 victims' relatives to Ukraine because of concerns about the security situation there, and few family members have expressed a desire to go. Malaysia's prime minister is vowing to do our best to bring back the victims of Flight 17. Mr. Najib Razak made that comment on a Facebook posting after meeting relatives of some of the 28 Malaysian passengers and 15 Malaysian crew members who were aboard the plane. The prime minister says he understands the pro-Russia insurgents in the area have agreed to create a safe passage for the recovery and investigation team. Malaysia's transport minister and other government officials are hoping to reach the crash site as quickly as possible. Steve Herman, VOA News, Kuala Lumpur.
Gabon has released 100 of some 500 Cameroonian, Chadian and Central African illegal immigrants detained for 10 months for unlawful mining. Some of the freed people say they were simple refugees from the CAR. Reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka talked with them in Cameroon's border town of Kiosi and has this report for VOA.
30 of the migrants flushed out of Gabon looked tired, hungry and sick. 24-year-old Ibrahim Alaman, who says he left his native Chad to look for a job in Gabon, tells VOA that he spent a month in the dispensary of the prison in Libreville, but was not treated for rashes all over his body. He says there was no medical assistance in the prison and is calling on those who can to help him and other refugees who are still detained in Gabon. Imvram Zuli, a refugee from the Central African Republic, says he and those with him were arrested during a raid organized by Gabonese authorities. He says that after being abused by the police, they were transferred to the town of Oyem, where they spent 3 days before returning to Bitam to be judged.
Je ne sais pas pourquoi on m'a arrêté. J'ai fait 10 mois de prison.
He says he does not know why he was arrested and imprisoned for 10 months when Gabonese authorities know that in the CAR there is war, there is insecurity, and it is very difficult to leave. Zuli adds that the rights of the migrants were never respected in prison.
On a souffert, je vous assure, on a vraiment souffert. En prison là-bas, c'était très difficile.
He says they really suffered and prison conditions in Gabon are horrible. According to the ex-prisoners, the police raids targeted people illegally residing in Gabon. A total of 500 individuals from African countries, including Mali and Benin, were arrested. 18-year-old Linda Kumani, who is also from the CAR, says she had asked for asylum after fleeing the carnage in her country, but the Gabon police did not take that into consideration.
I'm a refugee from Central Africa and I seek asylum in Gabon, but they have arrested me for 7 months and maltreating me there. I don't understand why they maltreat me here while I was still suffering in my country, Central Africa.
Among the ex-prisoners arriving here in KOC were 24 Cameroonians. 34-year-old Leonard Kibi told VOA that 7 of them were too sick to return to KOC.
By the grace of God that we are alive, the poor have maltreated us enough even to eat rice every day during these 8 months we have spent there. They even refused to give us tablets.
The governor of Cameroon's South Region, Jules Marcelin Jaga, told VOA that Cameroonians should avoid traveling to Gabon without their official documents.
They have a very beautiful country. They have to stay here in their country. And if one day they go out, they have to respect the law and regulation in force in that country.
Equatorial Guinea also recently expelled hundreds of Cameroonians for failing to produce residence permits. The move has been interpreted as a violation of the terms governing the movement of goods and people in the Central African Economic and Monetary Community, CEMAC. Cameroon, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, Central African Republic, Chad and Congo-Brazzaville are members of the bloc. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News. KOC, Cameroon.
Hundreds of young Africans have spent several weeks in the United States to participate in a program meant to enhance leadership skills, entrepreneurship, and connect young African leaders with one another and with Americans. The Young African Leaders Initiative, YALI, was launched by U.S. President Barack Obama in 2010 and has since held 15 exchanges and sponsored over 1,200 sub-Saharan scholars to visit America. Sani Dantuni Bello, one of the 2014 YALI fellow scholars who hails from Nigeria, spoke with VOA's Vincent Macquarie from our Washington, D.C. studios about the importance of attending the leadership conference.
I feel that I require more skills. I need to sharpen my skills, leadership skills. I need to learn more in terms of partnership, because in my agency, we adopted what we call the four P's paradigm in preventing human trafficking. Yes. Prevention, prosecution, protection, and partnership. So I'm here in the United States to learn more about protection, prevention, and partnership.
Now, up to this point, do you feel like you have something that you're going to go back home with, which you will say, this is new, this is different?
Yeah, for me, Vincent, the journey to this Washington Fellowship was an experience on itself. you know, there were more than 15,000 applications from Nigeria, from which only 45 fellows were selected. And coming here to the United States, my host institution, Howard University, I have been exposed to a broader understanding of public management models and practices. I have also had the opportunity to interact with a cross-section of government officials from Capitol Hill to the State Department. And I have also been able to meet with non-governmental organizations like Polaris Project and Coalition Against Child Labor. So I think I have learned a lot to take back with me to Nigeria.
How confident are you that when you go back and you talk to those that you work with, perhaps some of your superiors, they will understand that you need to inject a few fresh, different new ideas in the way you run things over there?
Luckily enough for me, I work with an agency that appreciates and welcomes change, innovation, and creativity. So I think I will have no difficulty getting those my new skills across. My agency is basically an agency, the workforce are basically a young person with appetite for change. So I believe I will have no difficulty getting my ideas across.
So very quickly, what's your overall assessment of the YALIC initiative?
Well, I think the YALI initiative has been largely successful, not just because that we come here to America to acquire new skills, but because it has laid a very solid foundation of partnership between the next generation of African leaders and America. Also, the YALI have created a platform, a social media platform. It has created a big network where young African leaders can come together, interact and share ideas. I think that is a huge success on itself.
I suppose you've met people here from different African countries that you would never have met if you were on the continent.
Yes. And I will say to my African leaders, young African leaders, that they should aspire to serve before they aspire to lead.
Sani Dantuni Bello, a young African leadership fellow. He spoke with VOA's Vincent Macquarie in our Washington, D.C. studios. Sierra Leone's chief medical officer, Dr. Brian Makagbo, has confirmed that there are three cases of the Ebola virus in the capital, Freetown. I spoke with Dr. Kagbo on the line from Kenema, Eastern Sierra Leone, where he noted that the Ministry of Health is putting some new mechanisms in place to contain the spread of the virus.
We currently have, as at the 19th of July, we have 405 confirmed cases of Ebola in the country, and we have 133 confirmed deaths, and we now have 96 survivors.
There are reports of the virus in the capital, Freetown. Could you please confirm that?
We have three cases that were confirmed in Freetown. All the three positive cases were people who left the eastern part of Sierra Leone and came to Freetown, and they've also been taken back to the Kenema Government Hospital for clinical management.
How would you assess the general atmosphere in the country? Are people in a panicked state?
Believe you me, I'm currently in Kenema, where we have the second wave of this epidemic, where, as I speak to you, 110 persons have been confirmed. I do not see any state of panic. The only panic that I'm seeing is a head workers who are actually manning the treatment facilities because of the workload, the inadequate human resource that we have. But among the general population, I have not seen any panic, even in Freetown. Kanaunga, I was there about 2 weeks ago, and now in Kenema, I have not seen any panic among the general population.
What new mechanisms do you have in place to contain the spread of the virus?
Well, what we have actually done as a ministry to ensure that we continue to engage community members, to actually empower them, for them to feel part of the response, because we know there is a lack of understanding among community members on the denial, rejection, and mistrust among health workers. And also what we've done is to try as much as possible to break the chain of transmission by doing active case shots in our facilities and healthcare level, and at the same time do contact tracing of positive patients. And the last but not the least is to actually provide care to whoever is infected, and also put in an effective infection prevention and control mechanism in our healthcare facilities. So these are the three key strategies that we are actually adopting to ensure that we slow down the spread of the virus in our country.
Dr. Brian Makagbo is Sierra Leone's chief medical officer. He spoke with me from Kenema, Eastern Sierra Leone. The Somali government says urgent humanitarian aid is needed to avert unfolding drought and potential famine in the East African country. Somali Minister of Agriculture Abdi Mohamed Bafo tells VOA Somali Service that the country risks drifting into a disaster due to increase in food prices, insufficient rain and insecurity. The minister says residents living in several towns and villages in south and central Somalia imposed blockade by Al-Shabaab militants are those likely to be severely affected.
The government of Somalia has been collecting some information from the regions and the districts to confirm this. And now that the government has decided to declare that the drought situation in the country is real and should be taken very seriously. This is in support of previous declarations, statements given by the international community, and we hope that this government stand will also support the drive of the international community to ensure that sufficient funds are made available for emergency response to this drought.
That was Somali Minister of Agriculture, Abdi Mohamed Bafo. A rehabilitation clinic in central Gaza was destroyed by Israeli military fire this week, a tragic event that was underscored the humanitarian cost of Israel's battle with the Palestinian group Hamas. VOA's Gabe Joslow visited the Wafa clinic, where one doctor says he has done all he can to protect his patients.
Hospital staff relocated the patients at the Wafa clinic to the first floor after the hospital was repeatedly hit by Israeli strikes. It is the only rehabilitation facility in Gaza. Of the 17 patients there, most are unconscious, hooked up to feeding tubes and catheters.
He can't see, he can't talk, he can't do anything. Feeding is through the tube. Same thing, he's been sleeping since he's in. The other one, he's sleeping for the last 2 years, 2 days, 60 days, drowned in his own pool, 15 minutes underwater.
Basman Alashi is executive director of the Wafa Clinic. He says his patients have suffered from spinal and brain injuries. Others were incapacitated by cancer, electric shock, and other accidents. They were all paralyzed, with little chance of recovery, he says, and are completely helpless without 24-hour care.
These are patients. Yeah. I mean, I don't understand why the Israelis are targeting these helpless people. And I cannot leave them, because if a glass flew at them, they cannot even raise their hand to protect their face. And I have to be here to protect them.
Walking through the hospital's deserted upper floors, Alashi points out the damages caused by Israeli strikes. Elevators destroyed, some clunky bits of shrapnel on the floor.
This is our home. This is the fourth floor. It used to be occupied by men. All rooms were filled, lots of activities. So as you can see, it's empty. These, the four missiles that they were fired on Friday, this is what's left over, part of what's left over from a drone, artillery, or tanks.
The Israeli military has said the damage sustained at the clinic was the result of strikes targeting Hamas rocket sites in a nearby building. The military repeatedly warned Alashi to evacuate the building, which he refused to do. On Thursday, he says, he was finally forced to flee when the Israeli military called and warned that a direct hit was coming. An Israel Defense Forces spokesman, Captain Eitan Buchman, blamed Hamas for launching rockets in the vicinity of the building. Alashi denies any militant activities take place in the Wafa buildings.
We are known to the Israelis. The Israelis are very well aware of the services that we provide. Why did they target us?
He says he has had to evacuate all of the patients to another clinic. The United Nations says 16 health facilities have been damaged since Israel began Operation Protective Edge, ordered by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to counter Palestinian rocket fire coming from Gaza. 13 additional primary care facilities have been closed because of their location near targeted sites. More than 300 Palestinians have been killed during the campaign of airstrikes, naval assaults, and ground operations, while more than 2,000 people have been injured. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. Music from our African collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, July 20th. With the 2014 FIFA World Cup now over, the qualifiers for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, to be staged by Morocco, have resumed in matches played so far this weekend. In the first round of the third stage of the qualifiers, Uganda, Botswana and Sierra Leone scored impressive victories that may serve them well in the return leg matches in a fortnight. All three won their matches by the same 2-0 scoreline. Uganda beat visiting Mauritania, Botswana playing at home defeated Guinea-Bissau, while Sierra Leone utilized home advantage to beat Seychelles. Four more matches are slated for today, Sunday. The aggregate winners of the two-leg third stage will advance to the final qualifying round, which is the group stage, to join the 21 teams that have already drawn a bye into that stage. The group stage comprises 28 teams drawn into seven groups of four teams each. Group stage qualifiers will kick off in September, with the top two in each group plus the best third-place team qualifying for the finals. Host Morocco is an automatic qualifier. Talking about the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, watching the World Cup in Brazil has convinced the football stars of Kenya that they can qualify for the 2015 tournament in Morocco. Kenya, which is famous for its athletes, has not featured at the Continental Football Showpiece since making a first-round exit 10 years ago. But goalkeeper Jeremy Onyango of the Harambee Stars, as the Kenyan team is known, believes that is about to change. Onyango was among the 16 players and four coaches who traveled to Brazil thanks to the generosity of President Uhuru Kenyatta. The head of state told the national team he would bankroll a visit to the World Cup after they won the regional CECAFA Challenge Cup last December. Onyango told Kenyan reporters that the trip was an eye-opener for him and his teammates. Seeing is believing. We watch the stars from the stands and realize they do not possess extraordinary skills that we lack. We only need to believe in ourselves and we will do well in the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, he says. Should Kenya eliminate Lesotho in a two-leg tie, it will join 2013 Africa Cup runners-up Burkina Faso, Angola and Gabon for the group stage. The six-match group phase kicks off in September and will last 3 months. As I reported earlier, the top two finishers and the third best placed team are guaranteed places at the tournament. Back here in Nigeria, the country's under-20 women's national team, nicknamed the Falconets, are now gearing up for the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup, starting on August 5th in Canada. Also, the country still remains on course for the CAF Under-17 Championship, as its qualifier against Rwanda, earlier set for this weekend, has already been shifted to July 27th. Nigeria is back in reckoning for the tournaments because World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has lifted the suspension it imposed on the Nigeria Football Federation, NFF, due to government interference in sports. The suspension from international football was lifted on Friday. A FIFA statement said the Global Federation has noted that the court proceedings and order preventing the president of the NFF, the NFF Executive Committee members, and the NFF Congress from running the affairs of Nigerian football have been withdrawn, as statutory order has been reinstated at the NFF and the legitimate bodies reinstalled. FIFA has decided to lift the suspension, the statement said. Nigeria's reinstatement comes after a reversal of the decision to remove senior members of the NFF following allegations of corruption. Africa's other representative at the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup, Ghana, has already landed in Canada to continue with preparations for the competition. Ghana is in Group A with host Canada, Finland, and former champion North Korea. The Black Princesses, as the Ghana team is known, and the hosts will play in the tournament's opening match at Toronto's National Stadium. For its part, Nigeria is in the same group as England, South Korea, and Mexico. Nigeria opens its campaign against Mexico on August 6th. Let's recall that while Nigeria remains suspended, South Africa made a bid to replace the country at the FIFA tournament, sending a delegation led by President of the South African Football Association, Danny Jordaan, to FIFA. In more African football news, host Namibia has been drawn into a tough group that includes perennial winner Nigeria for the 2014 African Women's Championship to be held from October 11th to 25th. According to the draw, conducted in the Namibian capital, Windhoek, on Saturday, Ivory Coast and debutant Zambia are also in the same Group A as Namibia and Nigeria. Group B comprises South Africa, Cameroon, Algeria, and Ghana. The 2014 African Women's Championship is also a qualification tournament for the 2015 African Women's World Cup, with the top three qualifying for the finals in Canada. The tournament marks the first time that host Namibia will feature in the African Championship. Nigeria has won all but two editions of the two yearly tournaments since it started in 1998. Equatorial Guinea is the only other winner. And former Lorient coach Christian Gourcuff has succeeded Vahid Halilhodžić as coach of Algeria. The Algerian Football Federation has announced Gourcuff has been handed a contract leading up to the 2018 World Cup in Russia, with a more immediate target being the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in Morocco. Halilhodžić stood down after leading Algeria to the last 16 at the World Cup for the first time in Brazil. Finally, former World Cup winning captain Dunga is the favorite on a short list of candidates to coach Brazil's national soccer team. The 50-year-old Dunga, whose real name is Carlos Blendon Berry, previously coached Brazil from 2006 to 2010, where he won the 2007 Copa America and the 2009 FIFA Confederations Cup. He was fired by the Brazilian Football Confederation after losing to the Netherlands in the quarterfinals of the 2010 World Cup. A new coach to replace Luis Felipe Scolari is expected to be named next Tuesday. Scolari, who guided Brazil to its fifth World Cup title in 2002, resigned as coach after the 2014 tournament, where the hosts entered as hot favorites but finished fourth. They were also humiliated by eventual champion Germany 7-1 in the semifinals and then lost the third place match 3-0 to the Netherlands. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. We'll be back again next Sunday for another look at Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
This is the
lady. Like man, She go say anything man do himself he do. She go say him equal to man. She go say him get power like man. She go say anything man do himself he do. I never tell you finish. I never tell you. She go on take cigar before anybody. She go on make you open door for him. She go on make him man wash break for him for kitchen. She wants salute man, she go sit down for sure. She wants salute man, she go sit down for sure. She wants sit down for table before anybody. She won't sit down for a table before anybody. She won't take piece of meat before anybody. She won't take piece of meat before anybody. Call 'em for dance, she go dance, lady dance. Call 'em for dance, she go dance, lady dance. African woman go dance, she go dance the fire dance. African woman go dance, she go dance the fire dance. She know him man a master, she go cook for him, she go do anything he say. But lady no be so, but lady no be so, but lady no be so, but lady no be so. Lady no master, lady no master, lady no master. Call him for dance. She go dance, lady dance. Call 'em for dance. She go dance, lady dance. African woman go dance. She go dance the fire dance. African woman go dance. She go dance the fire dance. She know him man a master. She go cook for him. She go do anything he say. But lady not be so. But lady not be so. But lady not be so. Lady na be so, lady na master, lady na master, lady na master, lady na master. If you call a woman, African woman, no go greet.
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former United Nations Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Here's Dr. Joner.
Good evening, Africa. At the sixth summit of the BRICS countries, a small group of emerging economies, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, which was held in Brazil last week, a decision was finalized to establish a development bank. It is the hope and expectation that this new development bank would offer a soft window to struggling developing and emerging countries. The initiative to set up this bank was taken at the BRICS fifth summit meeting that was hosted by South African President Jacob Zuma in Durban, South Africa, 26-27 March 2013. At that time, with a number of heads of state and government attending as observers, it was agreed to establish a new development bank. It was further agreed that a contingent reserve arrangement would be set up. The arrangement should have an initial size of United States dollar $100 billion. However, nothing concrete was announced and further details were postponed. Now, at the sixth summit in Brazil, final decisions were taken for the establishment of the new development bank. Initially, the bank will commence with United States dollars 50 billion in initial capital. Also announced was an, quote, emerging reserve, unquote, fund, contingency reserve arrangements of United States dollars, $100 billion. The capital of this bank will be split equally among the five participating states. Therefore, there will be no weighted voting. The bank will have its headquarters in Shanghai, China, and the first president of the bank will come from India. It is also envisaged to set up a regional headquarters in South Africa. The main function of the bank would be to mobilize resources for infrastructure and sustainable development projects in BRICS and other emerging economies and developing countries. Nearly all economic commentators on this BRICS decision concluded that the setting up of the new development bank is a direct challenge to the World Bank and the IMF and other regional banks linked to these Bretton Woods institutions. For too long, emerging economies as well as developing economies have been complaining of the heavy hand of the World Bank and the IMF. The structure and leadership of these banks have not changed since they were established at the end of the Second World War. The arrangements for weighted voting still ensure that the preponderant power and influence are in the hands of the major Western powers. African economies such as Professor Adebayo Adeniji were in the forefront in criticizing the IMF structural adjustment program as well as resisting the concept of the Washington consensus. There are also further conditionalities applied by these banks that developing countries find worrisome. It is now expected that the new BRICS Development Bank would follow a different path. At least this new bank will be a serious challenge to the IMF and the World Bank. It remains to pose the question whether Nigeria, with the largest population in Africa, will join the BRICS. When South Africa was invited by the BRICS countries to join them in their third summit in Sanya, China, South Africa was then regarded as the largest African economy. Now, things have changed. In 14th April this year, Nigeria recalculated its GDP by taking into account such 12 factors such as telecom, banking, and Nollywood. Nigeria added 89% to GDP, now worth $510 billion, thus surpassing South Africa's $370 billion. China, a member of BRICS, is the second largest economy in the world. Brazil remains a large economic powerhouse in Latin America. It would be of the utmost importance to determine how the global economy would function alongside this new BRICS Development Bank. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoy the program. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Odette Frazier. Hope you'll join us again on Saturday. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned about the rapid escalation of violence in Libya that could lead to widespread conflict there. In February 2011, a band of former politicians, former military officers, tribal leaders, intellectuals, members of civil society, and the business community from all over Libya met to form a government opposed to the authoritarian rule of then-Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. This coalition government, the National Transitional Council, united all factions who fought as one to rid the nation of the brutal tyrant and his adherents. Working together, they succeeded. On October 23, 2011, the council officially declared Libya to be liberated. None of this could have happened without the strong cooperation of all strata of the Libyan people. Disregarding regional, tribal, and political differences, they united to open the door to a bright new future for Libya. But unfortunately for Libya and its people, this spirit of cooperation is now being tested. And today, significant security challenges remain. Rival militia groups have escalated fighting, most recently clashing over control of Tripoli's airport. Not only does their violent struggle for power destabilize the country and impede Libya's progress towards establishing a functional democratic government, it also dishonors the spirit of the revolution to build a new state based on mutual respect and the rule of law. The United States affirms its support for Libya's democratic transition and urges the seating of the new Council of Representatives as soon as possible, said State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki. We stress the vital role Libya's Constitution Drafting Assembly plays in building the new country for which Libyans sacrificed so much during the revolution. Its work must advance without interference or violence. Libya's future will not be secured through force of arms, but only through a political accord and national dialogue that allow the state to ensure security and rule of law throughout the country. We urge all parties to engage in constructive dialogue to resolve their disputes. The United States will continue to stand with the Libyan people as they navigate these challenges and build a free, prosperous, democratic, and secure state.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.